Hey everyone, welcome to the BizCast. This is going to be the first in a series of conversations about Israel-Palestine. I am leaving my work with the RCA on Israel-Palestine at the end of 2025. Chris DeBlay, who works with me now, is finishing at the end of September. And so he and I are going to have a few conversations about Israel-Palestine, just sort of reflecting on our time. Mine started in 2016, his in 2022. And I'll probably also have a conversation or two with my dad, Marlon, who started working on Israel-Palestine with my mother in 2006. Maybe my mom will join us at some point for a conversation. Public speaking is not her favorite, so no guarantees there. So I hope we find this helpful. It is sort of broadly focused on Israel-Palestine, but also on American politics, though we did record this before the assassination of Charlie Kirk, so there's nothing in here about that. I hope you find it helpful.
Yeah, almost 3 years for me.
Almost 3 years for you, and then it ends up being like a crazy 2 years, at least, of the three.
Right.
And then whatever else we want to talk about. I mean, like the drawing that Trump definitely didn't do, you guys. I promise. That doesn't even just because it looks exactly like his signature, like perfectly, it's too perfect. That's why it's not him.
That's correct.
The forgery is too good.
Too good.
Whatever. Who even knows today, tomorrow, a week from now, what we'll be hearing. But I mention it because like there's like this top line absurdity to everything, and yet the absurdity is all very serious and is
very
like
serious.
Affecting the lives of millions of people and has like wrecked and ended the lives of millions of people. And on the Epstein thing, there are countless victims. One of the most high profile of the victims has committed suicide. I know her first name is Virginia, but I don't know how to say her last name. It's like Goofrey or but I've never heard it pronounced. So it's like, and yet the absurdity of it all is like at times laughable. And we do laugh about it. And because it's over, I don't know. You get overwhelmed. With something that is this serious and yet this unserious, right? Because like having to listen. So on the Trump side, it's like people will tell you reality is not reality, right? And we've gone through this over and over and over again. And he's comically unqualified and like cruel and shameless people like run the government, and you're just like, I don't know, like it's so bizarre. And then you'll watch what Israel's doing and you'll hear their spokespeople come and just say, no, that's not what's happening, like on the famine and the starving. No, we're not starving people,
right?
And you're like driven almost to madness, it feels like, on a daily basis in new and exciting ways every day. You're just like, wow, who could have even if I had sat down with 10 really involved people, like thoughtful people, I don't think we could have imagined this level of
absurdity.
Absurdity.
But it becomes normal. That's the real thing I've been wrestling with. I think one of the things is just how quickly we adapt as human beings, and our brains desire to make things normal, and therefore I assume in some sense kind of safer, or at least we don't have to spend as much maybe energy because we've normalized our environments and the things that are taking place in it.
We have to.
It's survival,
right? At some level, we don't have a choice. I think
Just really quickly, I don't want to interrupt your thought for long, but I thought normalization would mean like acceptance, but it's not even really
No,
that. It's just like
no.
this thing is happening, and we all just have to deal with the fact that it's happening. And if it keeps happening long enough, we lose the energy to kind of focus on it and confront it and continue to like
Right.
struggle against it if it's something we're
Yes.
against.
Yeah.
And it just becomes kind of part of the tapestry of our
Yeah.
society.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, it becomes really hard to resist it if you are wanting to resist it and fight back against it. I think that's right. I just try to remember how I felt in February or in March when this administration was initiating its policies and its way of being in the world. The shock, the anger, the strength of my emotions to all of that. And it's just not the same today. It's not that I'm not those things, but yeah, it wears off or wears down or something shifts over time.
And partially out of a necessity, right, which maybe is tied to it's a physical. It's a mental, but also a physical. I gotta stop making this table move. Like necessity, because we're like amped up, right? What is that? There's terms for like low and high energy. That may come to me at some point. If Bethany were here, she would know what
She
I'm
would help. Yep, she would help.
getting at. Oh, hypo and hyper arousal, right? And this. It's like you have these things happening and they're creating hyper arousal, but like you just tire out eventually.
Yeah, you can't do that forever.
Right.
Right.
You can't do that
I'd
forever.
say same is true around Israel Palestine,
Yeah.
especially the last couple of years. It has been for me very, very difficult to stay engaged. And I don't mean just paying attention to the news and what is happening, but I mean emotionally engaged.
For sure.
Right. And so that's when you were saying at the beginning, you know, what are your broad kind of general thoughts about your experience? That's one thing that comes to mind. It's not the only thing, but it is one thing, just the struggle of and for me, only speaking personally, nothing more than that, I can feel like my desire to protect myself from the pain, from the atrocity, from the helplessness, the hopelessness. And so it's easier to just not feel at all, or to skirt by it, you know, or to keep it purely academic and in my intellectual, in my mind. So that's been a real hard thing. Yeah, that's one thing that
Yeah.
strikes me.
Oh. There's no doubt. Anybody who's been paying somewhat careful, but if you're paying especially careful attention to this, because it would be, I suppose there was a lot of footage from the Iraq War while it was happening available on the internet, to some degree. I think that's true, but I can't imagine it was anything like what we have now, because you
No way.
didn't have widespread adoption of smartphones by
Right.
then. It was a lot of, I think, people using GoPros. So, like, I think American soldiers and probably also Iraqi and who am I thinking of? Various extremist Islamic groups that we were fighting wherever at the time, right? Had those. So it's almost like it's almost an experiment in what can humans
absorb and what happens to them if they absorb this much material, like video material of a distant conflict that they care about, right? And that their country's involved in the case of the United States and Israel and lots of other European countries. Like, what we don't know what that does to a person. I mean, we
Yeah,
have
we're guinea
some things like
pigs, right?
secondary trauma, and I know there are terminologies for what it is, but on this kind of mass scale, I don't know. I
We're,
don't think there's
yeah.
anything quite, and I think we can both say, and I'm sure others too, it is, emotionally challenging. Because it stirs up a lot of sadness and anger. And then it mix that with helplessness. It's not a great stew.
Yeah,
It's a hard one.
it is very hard.
And that was already a part of this work to some degree, but just nothing.
No,
Nothing like this.
not the scale. No,
Nothing like this. I
I
think the
think.
other. Oh, go
Oh,
ahead.
good. I was just going to say, it just strikes me that like what we're talking about here is a really important thing for all of us to be thinking about whether or not this issue is something we pay super close attention to or not, because I think we're all more of us at this moment in history are bumping up against things that are overwhelming, that feel way beyond our ability to do anything about. And with some time in those situations, we feel, as we've been talking about here, like a dampening of our emotions, a difficulty of staying engaged fully. And I think we just need to give ourselves a lot of permission to not, we don't have to feel hyper, as you were saying, aroused, to be engaged. It's okay to maybe feel like there's some distance between you and the issue. That doesn't mean that you're bad or that you're not caring anymore. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I think I at least carry this idea that I have to feel it fully every time I encounter it, or else I'm somehow missing, I'm not being a good advocate or a good, and that just actually isn't, I don't know that that's possible. So anyway,
No.
that just a
Well,
thought that
and
strikes me.
it's but there's this difficulty of like, well, what even is the function of like bearing witness to something terrible? What does that do? I mean, it does something to you as a person, and there's some advocacy now you can do. Right, you can do it in your personal life, and you can do it on like social media. And you can go beyond that to representatives and such. But there definitely is a sense in which, if that was going to like quickly change things, well, it would have. There are enough people who care in the United States. It is a significant group. It's not significantly represented in our positions of in the United States government, but it is represented certainly in the Democratic Party strongly now, and it hasn't worked. It's worked to change the conversation, the political conversation, but it hasn't worked to change the situation on the ground, right? And it's like that is a really it's really hard to feel a lot of satisfaction
Yeah,
around
that's right.
that, right? So, in addition to being like, oh, you're taking on all this, you're consistently watching really difficult imagery, and then you do stuff about it, and the stuff you do about it doesn't change anything, really. Like that's a tough doom. That's like a doom loop that a lot of people are having to deal with. Ourselves included. And I don't have an answer to that because it's the same problem we would have in terms of internal politics of the United States. It's
Very similar complication. Yeah, it's how you're experiencing them on different levels. It's a really weird, and then not be, but then also not being like actually personally affected by all the bad things, like not in a very direct way. It's a very strange dynamic to live.
It is. Yep. It is.
I was also thinking about how I didn't realize that it would work for leaders, like Western leaders in this case. I guess that's an important caveat, to do like undemocratic, anti-rule of law, anti-human rights, and just kind of not apologize and not stop. In the case of, especially like Trump in this term, especially, and then also obviously Netanyahu since, really before October 7th, of course, but in a new and dramatically awful way after October 7th, just plow through all opposition. Just keep going. Keep going. Don't stop. Don't apologize. The types of things that would end a leader's time in power. Nope, just keep going. Don't stop. And that has worked.
It has worked.
And it's been hard to digest. Like sometimes I try to digest, like why has that worked?
Boy. I mean, we're recording this the day after Israel bombed Qom and Doha, Qatar, and to kill some Hamas leaders, which apparently they were not effective in doing, but they bombed a different country, and the United States, it sounds like, apparently did not approve. So even the US, if that's correct, did not
It's hard
approve
to,
of this,
I think we're still trying to figure out whether we like are pretending we didn't know for the sake of the
That's what's hard.
relationship with Qatar, because we're trying to have a good relationship with them. I mean, they've been the mediators the whole time between Israel and Hamas. Oh, because it would be quite surprising if Israel just did it. But this, we have seen these things start to happen now. So,
The fact that we're even having the conversation about it being possible is striking. It doesn't maybe even feel that all that striking anymore, given how far we've come. But to your point, we've just blown through norm after norm after norm, after rule after
100%.
rule, after law after law. And we're in just a place the international order has not been in for, I don't know, the end of World War II and the formation of all of these things.
Yes, except, and this is where it gets tricky for me, is like when you look back on US history, and my knowledge of our interventions around the world is like just kind of so-so.
Fair.
But since World War II, in the fighting of communism, right, we did a lot of this
We did.
meddling of taking out certain leaders that we didn't like because they were too socialist or leftist, typically. I don't know if there were a lot of right leaning, maybe. I don't know. I'm sure, surely there were some. All of which goes against international law, and we just kind of did it when and
Did
whenever we
it.
wanted. So I have sympathy for both narratives, and I don't really know exactly what to do about that. The one narrative is like, after World War II, we created this system of a rules-based order, and that was important. Human rights, international law, Geneva Conventions, and like post 9/11, it really started to crumble.
But then, people will say what I just said earlier, like, well, but in the 60s and 70s and 80s, probably the 50s, I don't know, 60s, 70s, 80s feels like the main time. We were meddling around in other people's affairs whenever we wanted, however we wanted, which was against international law. So isn't it actually true that we just kind of always just did what was ever in our best interest, and all this talk of us caring about human rights is just a front, just a lie we tell ourselves about our country. And I think we have to wrestle with that honestly, to some degree, that it was a lie we told ourselves. It was also true that there was, I think, something in our country. There were forces in our country who believed in those things and were trying to push our country in those directions, right? I also believe that is true. Certainly internally, we did that, civil rights movement, right? It does feel like all of those agreements are being undone, like informally, meaning within our country, we're losing the consensus, the post-civil rights consensus. I feel like we're losing. And internationally, we're losing the post-World War II consensus about international law and human rights. And it's also true that in some places, like, we never really got that. The civil rights movement never really was embedded in certain places in the States, like the South being principally one of them. Like, did they ever? Did the whites in the South ever fully get on board with the civil rights movement, or were they just quiet? I don't know. It's just these weird tensions
Yeah,
around
tensions, right?
the narratives are not clean,
That's right.
in the United States or concerning Israel. Like, were the 90s, the Oslo Accords, was Israel serious?
Right.
I don't know anymore. Like, part of me is like, I thought they kind of were. Or maybe I would say, I'm quite certain there was a segment of the population that was
There you
very
go.
serious about it.
That's what I would say. Yep.
I'm not sure if even the leaders who were pretending to be serious about it were or were not. Then again, Yitzhak Rabin died and got
Died, yeah.
assassinated trying to do
Right.
it. So you don't want to take that away from him. Right? Like,
Yeah.
if he was just kidding around,
Right.
it cost him his life. That's pretty
Yeah.
rough. That's
Yeah.
pretty rough. So all this, I'm just kind of bringing up a lot of messiness of how I think
I think
about
that's good.
history and the
Yeah.
present and who we are and who Israel is.
Yeah, we always want to put everything into nice categories that are clean and tidy. We want to tell our stories in ways that are that as well. It just, I'm with you. It just isn't ever clean or clear cut, I don't think. So.
It's not for me. Not for me. Not. It's not working, any kind of clear-cut history. Or even where we go from here. I feel
Right.
pretty
Right.
unsure.
Uncertain. Yeah. Yep.
You know, sometimes I look at, for example, I look at the Obama years, which I think if you lived them, if you're over the age of, say, 20 or 25, when that was happening, or older, and were left leaning, let's say. Like, those were genuinely, like, I can just tell you from my perspective, genuinely hopeful times. It felt transformative. It felt like we were really repudiating all the Iraq War, post 9/11 torture, Guantanamo, Obama had promised to close Guantanamo and he signed an executive order the first day he was in office. I mean, it really felt like we were
Yeah.
turning a corner, and to now have to look at that as sort of an exception. I mean, this is how I'm starting to look at those 8 years were an exception to a story of American imperialism. And then, of course, there are those who would say, well, let me tell you about some of the things Obama actually did. You won't like them all. Totally understand. Lots of drones being used on, at times, fully innocent people, weddings. I totally understand that. The global financial, we did inequality go down? Did wealth inequality go down under Obama? I mean, if it did, it wasn't sustainable, it wasn't durable. I think Obamacare was like, we really should have gotten something more than we did out of that majority. But gosh,
It
it
felt
was
hopeful
so
overall.
different. It
Certainly
felt
at the
so
beginning.
different to now. And then
It
to have
felt
to
like
look and be like, oh, that was like kind of a mirage.
well, it
I don't know.
to
I don't
me
even know
it's
how to look at it.
yeah, I guess I thought at that moment, I think if I had to try and put words to it now, I would say that we were on an ascent, and I'm gonna use a terrible analogy, I'm sure, but like a gondola. It's straight, we're headed up, things are going in a certain direction, yay.
Definitely.
And I think since then, I've been reminded, or I'm learning again, that history is not a straight line, of course. And it's more like, the fastest, craziest, sometimes upside down roller coaster. And we're upside down right now. And I love roller coasters, so it's not a perfect metaphor. That's fun. This is not fun. But history is, it's not a
It's
straight
more like we're
line.
upside down on that plane, that Denzel Washington movie where he's a drunk pilot, but he's like, maybe we're gonna land, like we're gonna do this upside down move, and then we're all upside down right now, being like, we're gonna die upside. This is worse. Just plummet, make it stop, That's how I mean, that's a different
That's
analogy, but
your metaphor.
so you're saying, so we're going, we thought we were going up on this thing with Obama. And then how do you see it now? Then you see it as not okay, like we could go back up.
I mean, I don't know how
I'm
far you
like,
have to
we'll
pan
never go
out.
up again. That's where I'm at right now.
I know you are.
I'm just like, so it's a slow upside down descent
I mean,
into.
I'm not a historian, okay, but I am trying to pay attention to history because we're not the first people to live in times of great transition and change for the worse. And those times were not descents that went on forever either. That descent did change. There was now, but again, I don't know how far you have to pan out. Are we talking a decade from now? Are we talking a couple lifetimes from now? I don't know.
I
But I am
understand that.
overall hopeful if I can pan out far enough. But yeah, to your point, I have no idea what the next 5 years are like. What my children's lifetime is going to hold for them. I have no idea.
It's tough for me to, when I, because if I go back far enough, then climate collapse comes into view.
Right. Comes back into play.
And I'm
I
like,
know.
oh yeah, that's right. That's also just continuing to happen. And we as a country, but to some degree, not I can't say the global community, because
That's
China is
right.
taking some real steps, which is so great. I mean,
Europe's engaged
a
still.
different kind of, right? If we had really, we're the biggest to blame here is the
We
United
are.
States. I just don't see how we can escape this one with our election of Trump in 2016, and obviously now again, but 2016 was really, well, definitive, because we left the Paris Climate Accords, which, were very imperfect, but they were like a step in the right direction. And so when I think back, think about how we're like obviously going in reverse on confronting climate collapse in the United States, then it's tough for me, because I'm like, we have to solve all these other existential problems current, and then maybe we can get to climate.
I hear you. Yeah, there's
So
plenty of reason for feeling for getting caught in a doom cycle like you were talking about.
That's right.
I am trying to remember that the future is always uncertain, and that is both terrifying and reason for hope, because
That's right.
things can happen and have happened throughout history that no one could have seen coming, that did shift things for the better.
But that's it's a really so this is hopeful pessimism is this term that I came across that this woman, van der Loot is her last name, wrote a book on it. And that's what she talks about. Like, you can be like, things don't look good. I have to be honest. But also the future is legitimately open and anything can happen. And so that should give us reason to fight for what we believe in and reason to hope because we can say without being Pollyannish or lying that the future really is open. Right? It's difficult. It becomes difficult when you start talking about agency, right? Okay, it's open, but I have no agency, right? Yes, that does make things more complex. But that's where I'm at. I guess the thing, as I was listening to you, I was thinking about is like when you say what you say, you're sort of admitting like we need something major to shake this system, right? Which is
That I
not
do believe.
something, 10, 15 years ago, you wouldn't have been like, if we don't get something major to shake this system, we are doomed. You would have been like, no, the system is kind of like finding its way in a decent, like we don't need something. Now we realize like, no, these structures, they've all been really undercut. Like, I don't know what institutions or leaders, like we're really devoid of leaders and we're devoid of institutions that people really trust. Like, I don't know who to name as a leader. And there are people that are kind of like promising. Like, I think AOC is promising.
But yeah, we're
Nobody
not
else
there
comes
yet.
immediately to mind, even internationally. Institutions. What would you
Oof.
name? I would have wanted to name our education or our higher ed to some degree in the United States, right? Like we built this amazing network of universities and colleges and research, but they've really shown their weakness in the face of. I think a few things and social change, like I think they showed real weakness in the face of people protesting Israel Palestine. Like they showed like a sort of an obvious bias towards Israel, which is just disappointing to me. And I think just generally, like in terms of what they're supposed to stand for, they could have at a minimum been more open. To the protesters. And then in the face of what Trump, the pressure he's put on them and to see them really fold, most of them, and the way that prices have just become obscene at the universities, like, right, it's like the system isn't very healthy, not accessible for most people. Corporate interests seem to be taking a toll on universities. And
So
so
this
I,
thing that you had, yeah, would have maybe held up.
would have maybe held
Is
up. I can't say that right now. And then I wouldn't know what to turn to say, hey, what about this? I don't know.
Agreed. If you're trying to identify what the thing is that's going to bring this significant change, that is very, very difficult for me to see as well.
I know.
But again, reality is wildly unpredictable, and so I'm going to lean into the potential goodness of that unpredictability. So I
I
can't see
think.
anything. I can't see anyone. Okay, well, that still doesn't mean that something can't shake things loose.
Definitely. I definitely agree with that. And I do sometimes find myself sort of looking for people who are imagining what that could be. Meaning, could it be manufactured, or does it need to just kind of appear?
Right.
I don't really know what the answer to that is, but I will say when I think of like what's happening, like say with the Democratic Party here in the United States, and just like how poorly it really has responded to what's been happening, right? Like a real lack of imagination at a minimum. And I would say even moral courage and moral clarity has been lacking in a way that I was surprised. And what I think it might be is like an overthinking of everything. Like instead of like using your intuitions as, let's say, a Democrat or a liberal, and the things you actually just care about and are passionate about and get you either upset or whatever, and just going with that, there's this overthinking that I think happens, like, oh, we need to test this with
Yeah, it's too calculated. It
it's
kind of,
all
maybe.
too calculated, right? And it does all that calculation is not working to combat what's happening. And
So
I
you're
and
trying to,
so and I don't really know what to make of that, or like what do you do then? But there has to be more
Yeah, that's why
authenticity. I just have
I
fond of
sus
buzzwords.
Yeah, right. I suspect that's why if anything is able to shake it loose, it likely will not come from the institutions.
Doesn't
For
seem like it.
example, a certain political party. I think because they are too calculated and too cautious, and they
Right.
want to protect whatever little semblance of power or influence they have, it's going to be someone or something that instead taps into human emotion. And the desires of humanity and the longings of humanity and the person who can speak that, or the group, or the whatever that can tap into that, that's how things might maybe shift. So I think that's what's happening in New York City, but we don't need to go down that necessarily with their mayor race. I mean, I think that's kind of what's taken place there, perhaps a little bit.
Yeah. I'm hopeful that the Mamdani, Zohran Mamdani's race in New York can be like, it's bizarre. It's bizarre because all these things, like we're going in between talking about Israel Palestine and our own country and all that stuff, but it's all interconnected.
It's all
Like
connected.
because we go to Mamdani and there's Israel Palestine all of a sudden,
Huge in that
right? Playing a
conversation.
huge role in that conversation, and it doesn't make it's very weird. It's
It's
so
weird,
weird.
right?
It's so weird. But I've experienced this with the East Coast, where there is this we're liberal on everything except Palestine. It was part of what was happening at Columbia. Columbia is in New York City. The biggest population of Jewish people outside of Israel is New York City. And the United States has, I think, almost the same amount of Jewish people in the United States as in Israel. In each case, it's about 7 million. And, with mostly good intentions towards the Jewish community and protecting Jewish people and having good relationships and allowing them to freely exercise their religion. It's all enmeshed and dysfunctional now because now the state of Israel is enmeshed in New York City politics as well, in the same way that the whole United States is enmeshed in Israeli and religion is playing a role, and conservative religion is playing a role in New York City. I mean, you have a pretty big community of Orthodox Jews, sometimes called Hasidic
issues. And there's varying views about that community within New York City, because it's extremely conservative, like kind of antisocial, right? They don't go to regular schools. They don't really participate in regular society within New York City. They're kind of, and all this stuff is a part of the Israel-Palestine United States conversation. What role is religion playing? What role is culture? What role is imperialism and colonialism playing? What role is white supremacy playing? Like all these things have been uncovered to be a part of kind of everything in a
Yeah,
way.
I will say that as we're kind of reflecting on our work in this part of the world, when I joined you back in 22, I did not anticipate, although I maybe should have, but whatever. I didn't anticipate the extent to what you just said is true. In other words, that I thought, yeah, I'm going to have this work now that will involve this part of the world over here and these people over here. And it's kind of a contained sort of thing, and you have to understand it, and that's true. But boy, the interconnectedness between that part of the world and the conflict there and the issues involved, and then what's happening in our country, and then even globally, not all of the world, but certainly other parts of the world have the same wrestlings around all those things that you just listed there. I didn't anticipate that, I don't think. So you think, oh, I'm going to go learn about Israel. People come on our tours and, oh, I'm going to go learn about Israel Palestine. Yeah, absolutely. But in doing so, you're going to also then have to wrestle probably more than you realized with your life back in the United States. They're connected.
For sure. And I have started to think of the United States of as being an apartheid system from essentially the end of slavery until the 60s. Slightly different depending on where you were living, but like, wasn't it essentially? I mean, we know from Ta-Nehisi Coates is the first one to where I learned this. He's a African American writer and analyst and just really interesting thinker. That, for example, the Nazis came to the United States and studied Jim Crow as a part of their work in figuring out what they wanted to do in Nazi Germany. Okay. Well, that's the 40s, obviously, or late 30s, who knows? And so you're like, oh, so we're in apartheid, and like we now see that Israel's obviously currently an apartheid country. We're highly, we became highly militarized. You just start to see all these really destructive and disturbing parallels that kind of emerge, right? It's Judaism, it's a Jewish state, and we like informally think of ourselves as a Christian country. So there's supposed to be this certain culture slash religion embedded as either informally in the case of the United States, formally in the case of Israel, is supposed to be the dominant culture. And you just start to see all the problems with all of this. It just doesn't, democracy and these other things don't go together. But yeah, I didn't fully appreciate that when I started in 2016. Especially considering I started before Donald Trump was first elected. So it's Obama. I've studied how Obama kind of came to learn about the extent of what the Israeli occupation looked like. Like this was as I'm starting this job, so I'm like a little bit like, oh, they're starting to understand how sort of what we're I was going to say devious the occupation is, but That sounds
Powerful, yeah. Yeah.
too close to like anti-Semitic tropes. That's
Right,
why I don't
right.
that word. But
Right.
like insidious, like it's everywhere. It's calculated. It's not haphazard. Like, hey, we're doing our best here to control these people till we get a political solution. Like, no, this is meant to oppress these people and keep them down and keep them pacified. And the Obama administration seemed, based on reporting, like to be learning about this. And so when I started, I thought I didn't think it would go backwards. I thought we would be heading towards more understanding, at least within the Democratic Party. And instead, what I've seen is the United States trying becoming more like Israel rather than Israel becoming, right? So we're post-apartheid, they're apartheid, and we're like wrestling with no longer being a white Christian ethno state. Like, we're not legally that anymore. They're still technically a European Jewish ethno state. And I'm looking and being like, all right, we'll bring them along this experiment that we're doing. And now here we are 10 years later, and we are reverting more towards their system. We're going authoritarian. We're doubling down on our white supremacy and our Christian supremacy. That's a tough, right? As I started to see those parallels and then to see us heading in that direction, that's been pretty painful and difficult to watch happen. But it is pretty clear to me that that's what's happening here and that it mirrors what's happening there, right? So then you get into like eliminationism. That's the next phase. If you choose this, like, there's one culture and group and religion that is correct and correctly this nation belongs to, right? Well, then you have a problem.
You have a
Because guess
problem.
what?
That's
There's
right.
actually other people in your nation that don't fit that and don't want that, don't want to be in a nation like that, didn't think they were in a nation like whatever the case may be. Well, then you have a problem because you need them eliminated somehow. Either they need to become powerless within the system, or they need
To go.
to be gone or ha not have certain rights or whatever the case may be. And then, but what do we get? We get mass deportation in the United States, and we get the genocide in Gaza. It follows a certain terrible logic that I had hoped we were leaving in the past. I think that's part of maybe what I've witnessed, right? With really having the opposite notion of where it was all going when I started.
Yeah, that's a tough reality to come to.
Super hard. It's super hard. So there's like a clarity that a lot of people are coming to, which is, apartheid, and then what's happening now is genocide and whatnot. But it doesn't feel like we're moving in a direction of remedying that. It's more like we're rubber stamping it, and then we're going to do similar things over here in the United States, actually. You had the right blueprint,
That's right.
as it turned out.